Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Psych Hope Self-Help Podcast, a space for women where psychology illuminates paths to healing hope and personal growth. I'm Dr. Jennifer McManus, a clinical psychologist, and I'll be your host. Each episode, we'll explore a different way to use psychology to enhance emotional wellness. Hope you enjoy the show. Hey everyone, it's episode 21. At the time this episode goes live, we'll be in the beginning of the month of February. If you've been listening to this podcast since it got started, then you've probably caught on that I am a fan of seasonal topics. And in that case, it should come as no surprise that I wanted to integrate something connected to love this month. While self-love and self-esteem are indeed topics that are relevant to Valentine's Day and have been studied in the field of psychology in different ways, I wanted to share a related but what I think is a far more valuable and even powerful concept in terms of self-healing. The topic I want to explore with you is compassion. This episode will provide an introduction to the psychology of compassion and will include findings from some classic psychological research studies. I'll also provide a quick overview of compassion-focused therapy, highlighting areas that I think are most relevant to informing self-help interventions. I'll also briefly offer and weave in a few ideas for incorporating compassion into one's own life as a self-help approach, but please know next week we'll continue our exploration of the topic of compassion by turning to the healing power of self-compassion, and you can expect a lot more practical tips on that episode. For this episode, I'll be drawing heavily on the work of Dr. Paul Gilbert, who is a clinical psychologist from the UK and the founder of a type of psychotherapy called compassion-focused therapy. Dr. Gilbert has published or edited over 20 books, more than 100 scholarly articles, and at least 50 book chapters. In 2011, he was awarded the Order of the British Empire, which is a British order of chivalry, for his contributions to mental health care. I'll be referencing portions of his book, The Compassionate Mind, from 2009, and a more recent article from 2020 titled Compassion, From Its Evolution to a Psychotherapy. I'll link to both references in the show notes for anyone who may wish to go deeper than the brief introduction I'll be providing on today's episode. So, what came to mind for you when I introduced today's topic of compassion? Perhaps terms like care, concern, love, or kindness popped into your mind. Some people also think of compassion as feeling sorry for someone or about something. And Dr. Gilbert gives us this precise definition of compassion. He called compassion a sensitivity to suffering in self and others, with a commitment to try to alleviate and prevent it. Gilbert often makes mention of us humans having tricky brains that are prone to suffering. Because of this, learning how the brain functions is a key part of compassion-focused therapy. Just interrupting here to tell you about a new resource I created for you. If you're experiencing high levels of work stress, this resource is for you. Please know, you're not alone. So many women are tired of work stress seeping into every area of their lives. Perhaps you can relate and want to do something about the negative impact work stress is having on you, but aren't sure how to get started. If this resonates with you, then I'd like to invite you to take a brief moment for yourself and try the Your Path Through Work Stress quiz. In 10 introspective questions, you'll learn more about your unique experience of work stress and which science-backed stress relief tools are most likely to help you reclaim your peace. Just head on over to psychhope.com/yourpath so you can take the first step down your best path through work stress. The quiz will also be linked in the show notes. Much like mindfulness, as discussed on last week's episode, compassion has been long understood in philosophical and spiritual teachings to play a key role in healing from suffering, but only recently has scientific research given attention to compassion. While mindfulness-based research began in the 1970s, it was not until the 1990s that compassion research got started. Gilbert and other scientists take a biopsychosocial approach to compassion. This means biology, psychology, and social contexts are all considered when scientifically researching the concept of compassion. The biological piece of understanding compassion is heavily rooted in evolutionary theory. This means there's going to be an emphasis on survival, reproduction, and motives. Humans, and all other life forms for that matter, have three main motives. First, to avoid harm. Second, to secure resources for our survival and reproduction. And third, to rest when safe. Any species that is under a threat or actively seeking resources cannot engage their rest and digest bodily functions. Mammals evolved to have basic motives related to caring behavior and include rescuing if in danger, feeding if hungry, and warming if cold. Caring is thought to be a precursor to compassion. When discussing caring and compassion, we're in the realm of social co-evolution. Gilbert eloquently refers to social co-evolution as interpersonal dances. To bring this term to life a little bit, consider the different roles one can experience when it comes to caring. Perhaps it is to give or to receive care. Gilbert also points out we can be compassionate towards others, open to receiving compassion towards us from others, and be self-compassionate. After 3 decades of scientific research in the area of compassion, we now know much about what occurs at the physiological level during caring behaviors. The hormones oxytocin and vasopressin have essential functions when it comes to caring for infants and also in what psychological researchers call pair bonding, as is the case with romantic partners. We also have the vagus nerve, which plays a primary role in the parasympathetic rest and digest system. Specifically, the parent or caregiver can stimulate the calming effects of the parasympathetic nervous system in the infant who is hardwired to receive these soothing signals. Attachment theory is also relevant to the psychology of compassion, and here we can consider the work of psychiatrist John Bowlby, a pioneer in research on attachment. I'll devote an entire episode to attachment, both infant attachment and adult attachment styles, in the future, but for our purposes today of an introduction to compassion, here are some key takeaways. There are 3 core functions of attachment. First, we have what is called proximity seeking and maintenance, which refers to instinctual behaviors designed to ensure access and availability to a caring other, staying close to each other for protection and care, if lost, to find and rescue, and if hungry, to feed. The second core function of attachment is the secure base. This is an environment that is free from threat. This secure base is made possible by parents or other caregivers watching over them and allowing the infants to explore and learn. The third core function of attachment is a safe haven. This is where the parent or other caregiver soothes the infant and helps the infant to regulate their emotions. Humans are biologically designed to expect and need emotion regulation to come from an outside source. The functions of the vagus nerve are at play here. We see this need for outside support throughout the lifespan, not just in the infant and parent or caregiver relationship. This is why reaching out for social support, like talking to someone when we're in emotional distress, helps us get through challenging situations. There's another classic study related to attachment that I want to reference here. It's taught in most Psychology 101 courses and was conducted by Harry Harlow. He studied infant monkeys and gave them the option of 2 different types of surrogate mothers. These surrogate mothers were not actual monkeys, they were more like a basic robot contraption of sorts. One of the surrogate mothers was made mostly of a soft terry cloth, but did not provide any food to the infant monkeys. The other surrogate mother did provide food to the infant monkeys, but she was only made of wire. The infant monkeys were more likely to choose the surrogate mother made of terry cloth, but who did not provide food. Findings from this study led to the conclusion that physical contact, rather than feeding, is more essential for soothing. I do want to mention that Harlow's study was conducted very early on, and there are far more protections in place these days for research involving animals, not to mention humans too. Poor little monkeys. So, returning to those core functions of attachment, we need a secure base to explore or better understand the world, and a safe haven to soothe. Both are needed for and involved with secure attachment. If care is absent or in those heartbreaking and extreme instances where abuse or neglect is involved, insecure attachment can result, along with it, the potential for mental health difficulties in the future. To provide an example of what these mental health difficulties might look like, I'm going to directly quote Gilbert here, who said, "When we are distressed, suffer setbacks or disappointments, rather than having an internal secure base and safe haven, we activate the threat system through harsh self-criticism." I do want to point out that this is only a potential for mental health difficulties. They're not inevitable. There are many factors that can increase our resiliency if there were disruptions during the infant attachment phase. These resiliency factors can protect us from mental health difficulties later in our lives. And I'll plan to do an entire episode related to the topic of resiliency in the future. Now, returning to the theory of infant attachment, we can draw on it to better understand self-compassion throughout the lifespan. Self-compassion can be thought of as functioning like a good parent to ourselves so that we can stimulate the calming parasympathetic effects on our own. And when might we need these calming effects? Typically, at times of increased stress or anxiety. From this biopsychosocial lens, heightened levels of stress and anxiety can be viewed not just as responding to a threat, but lacking the internal resources to soothe and comfort as well. Giving us a little more foundation on the psychology of compassion, Gilbert explained how it's widely accepted that compassion is a social process that was particularly adaptive during hunter-gatherer times of the human species. This is when groups were small and they shared resources. The research refers to this as a time of human caring and sharing. The more competitive intentions as we see in the world today can be traced back to the development of agriculture and tribalism. Now, with our base of the psychology of compassion set, let's explore how it informs the practice of compassion-focused therapy. This is a good spot for me to mention that I will not be providing a comprehensive guide to compassion-focused therapy. Rather, I'll be highlighting portions most relevant to informing our own self-help practices. So, as a little caution for anyone who is looking for all of the information about compassion-focused therapy, I'd recommend going straight to Gilbert's work for that. So, what is compassion-focused therapy? Gilbert described it as an integrative, multidisciplinary, process-based therapy that utilizes insights and wisdoms from many of the main schools of psychotherapy. Let's break that down. When it comes to therapy, integrative means pulling together in an intentional and meaningful way. Multidisciplinary means pulling from different disciplines or fields. In the case of compassion-focused therapy, we're including not just psychological, but also biological and social contextual understandings. The process-based part of the definition refers to the flexibility it gives therapists to mix evidence-based processes from different types of evidence-based therapies, as opposed to being restricted to only one type of therapy. On the therapy client side of things, it really allows their therapy to be highly customized to their individual needs and preferences. Compassion-focused therapy maintains that we experience what Gilbert calls the big three responses to life traumas or tragedies, those being anger, anxiety, and sadness. Compassion-focused therapy helps us to notice our different emotions, notice how they might be in conflict with one another, and find compassionate ways to have one emotion work with the other. If you're noticing that I'm using the word notice a lot, good. This noticing business may sound familiar, especially if you caught last week's episode on mindfulness. Just noticing and observing is a core part of practicing mindfulness. Given that mindfulness is key to developing a compassionate mind state, it is one of the many practices integrated into compassion-focused therapy. Gilbert explains that compassion-focused therapy encourages human competencies that promote facing suffering as opposed to avoiding it, and competencies that enable wise action. The human competencies that help achieve these aims are knowing awareness, empathic awareness, and knowing intentionally. It is these human competencies that take caring behaviors seen in all mammals to that of compassion that is unique to humans. These are all forms of self-awareness. Basically, that we are aware we can know things, that we are aware we can be empathic, and that we can intentionally direct our efforts at knowing. I'm going to directly quote Dr. Gilbert again here because when it comes to using these competencies in therapy, I really can't say it any better than him. Compassion-focused therapy engages in a lot of psychoeducation. Okay, and a side note here, psychoeducation is just a fancy way of saying providing education on psychological matters. So let me start that over. Compassion-focused therapy engages in a lot of psychoeducation to help clients develop the wisdom of how and why the brain is tricky, and then develop competencies for processes such as mindfulness, how to use our minds for imagining things that are helpful, to learn perspective taking and reasoning in ways that are going to be helpful, to behave in ways that are going to be helpful, to use our bodies to support our minds, such as using breathing exercises or maybe taking physical exercise, or attending to diet or learning assertiveness. Therapists who practice compassion-focused therapy regularly remind their clients that we were born into these bodies of ours with these tricky brains, as Gilbert would say, that we did not choose, that we experience an array of motives and emotions, panic or fear, for example, that we did not choose, and we are born into a time and with circumstances that we also did not choose. Compassion-focused therapists assist their clients with motive switching from competition to compassion, from threat system to soothing system. Difficult or even emotionally painful earlier life experiences can present us with challenges when it comes to compassion. Caring strategies evolved within an environment of trust, as opposed to those that were threatening, unstable, or maybe neglectful. Research shows that for people who experienced earlier environments that were considered threatening, unstable, or neglectful, that difficulties tend to be in the area of receiving compassion as opposed to showing compassion to others. It's important to note here, though, that the difficulty with receiving compassion applies to receiving compassion from ourselves, too. The therapeutic value of compassion is often misconstrued as having to be nice or kind all the time, or perhaps even weak. At its heart, though, the therapeutic value of compassion is about wisdom and courage and a commitment to being helpful, not harmful, to oneself and others. While it would be impossible to replicate the nuances of compassion-focused therapy outside the context of a therapeutic relationship, there are some key takeaways to consider in terms of informing our own compassion-focused self-help practices. We're going to get into these with a lot more depth next time when we focus on self-compassion, but I'd like to use the rest of today's episode as an opportunity to plant a few seeds. We can show ourselves compassion in the type of self-talk in which we engage, for example. So many people say harsh, critical, and harmful things to themselves all the time. Things that we would never say to a friend or a loved one, but here we are, mentally beating ourselves up left and right. We're going to explore how we can talk to ourselves in more compassionate ways next time when exploring self-compassion. And also on the episode after that, when we'll consider self-help approaches inspired by cognitive behavioral therapy. Many things that help us shift from the threat system or the fight or flight response ruled by the sympathetic nervous system to the soothing system or the rest and digest response ruled by the parasympathetic nervous system can be conceptualized as showing ourselves compassion. As is often the case on this self-help podcast, we're not starting from scratch here. Last week's topic, mindfulness, can be considered a path to compassion. The episode before that, on the psychological benefits of physical exercise, also contains ideas of how we can use our bodies to support our minds in compassionate ways. I have also created guided meditations to accompany certain podcast episodes, all of which are available on my YouTube channel. In addition to the videos I've made to go alongside some of the episodes, there are other resources available on my YouTube channel for using our minds and bodies in compassionate ways. There are mindfulness meditations and deep calm breathing exercises, plus a soothing place visualization. My @ over there is psych_hope, and I'll link to my YouTube channel in the show notes too, in case you want to give any of those soothing strategies a try. Subscribing to my YouTube channel will let you easily know when I publish new self-help videos, and subscribing or following this podcast wherever you may be listening ensures that you never miss a new psychology-informed self-help episode. So I hope you enjoyed this introduction to the psychology of compassion. Please tune in to part 2 of this exploration of the concept of compassion as we turn our attention to the healing power of self-compassion on the next episode. Catch you next time. The information shared on the Psych Hope Self-Help Podcast is done so with the understanding that it does not constitute professional help, nor is it a substitute for professional help. If you think you might benefit from more than self-help, there are resources listed in the show notes.